Welcome everyone, my name is Chris Deasy, and for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews, my guest is Nigel Nelson, the longest serving political editor in Fleet Street, who works for The Mirror and The People. And we recorded the interview at the beginning of April 2022, on the afternoon when the Prime Minister and the Chancellor received fines from the Metropolitan Police for attending a party in Downing Street during lockdown. Nigel discusses his take on events, how it will unfold, and we learn that he is on his seventh Prime Minister in his tenure at Fleet Street, and why he still has a frisson of excitement every time he walks into the Commons. We talk about the way news and politics has changed over the decades. It's now a 24/7 operation. We talk about political biographies. We talk about how the facts don't always tell the full story. We learn how from an early age he had an interest in politics and a talent for writing. We learn why he would rather be on the sidelines than becoming one of the players. We talk about some of the politicians he admires from the other side of the political spectrum. We talk about Prime Minister's Question Time as really being a show, and how politicians don't often get along with fellow politicians on their own side. We learn Nigel's favourite film is Zulu. We learn about his interest in Gregorian chants and his thoughts on organised religion. We learn that his mother was a spy and why he would rather reveal than keep secrets, and why he turned his back on university. We talk about the experience of being married to somebody with a diametrically opposite political position. And at the end of the interview, Nigel talks about how he has had a ball in his life and career, and why he is a forward-looking person. It was an enormous privilege for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews to meet Nigel Nelson. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is a great pleasure to have Nigel Nelson in my office this afternoon. And Nigel, just before we started recording, of course, both of us were talking about what's happening in the news this very afternoon. When this podcast goes out, who knows what the shape will be of this afternoon's news, which is that the Prime Minister, the Chancellor and the Prime Minister's wife have received fines for Partygate.
Yes, and politics doesn't seem to stop. It's been absolutely extraordinary the last few years. And here we go again. And at the moment, because it's broken, I mean, I think it's about an hour ago, so before I came in to see you, that this actually broke. I'm still processing in my own mind what it actually means, that Keir Starmer has already come out and said Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak must resign. I'm not quite so sure of that at the moment, on the basis that we've moved on a bit. We are in the middle of the Ukraine war. And if you start getting rid of the Prime Minister, it's not just him you get rid of. You end up getting rid of the entire command structure. There is a big question while we're in the middle of a war and trying to avoid World War III, whether you want to change the leader and all the people around him at this particular time. As I say, I haven't come to a conclusion about this, but that's my thought process is going on as we speak. By tomorrow morning, when I do some television, I think I'll have that better worked out of my own mind.
And it's really funny, because with my own students, we've been looking at notions of leadership in the context of theology, religious studies. And at the very beginning of the semester, we were all, you know, looking at whether the Prime Minister could go. There were a couple of Prime Minister's question times during the class on a Wednesday. We were like, you know, will we still have a Prime Minister in office at the end of the session? And then, as you say, events overtaken by the Ukraine war. And just a few months ago, obviously, everything that was, you know, whether it was with Brexit or we've had recent storms, there always feels as if there's some crisis, which in COVID, of course, which has been, you know, all encompassing for the last 2 years. So what we've had, both politically on the micro level, the macro level, all these forces all coming together, no gap between any of them. So as you say, whereas a few months ago, the call for Boris Johnson to resign would have been overwhelming, we now find ourselves, even Roger Gale, the local MP here, saying, yes, he was calling for the Prime Minister to go, but now he's not so sure for the very reasons that you've outlined.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And as you said, politics has been relentless for certainly the last few years. There's always a new event coming up. And I think it would have been, had these fines broken before the Ukraine war had started, I think that he would have gone, and I don't think there would have been a major problem, because you would have had a new command structure in place before the war started. Margaret Thatcher went during the lead-up to the Gulf War, for instance. So that wouldn't have been an issue. When you're right in the middle of it, and everything is so delicate, I think it's much more difficult to get rid of your national leader.
And in your case, of course, we see you often on television doing the newspaper reviews. And now you're the longest serving political editor for the Mirror in Fleet Street, of course. So you work for the Mirror and the People.
That's right, yes. And so we are, broadly speaking, Labour supporting papers. And so I'm now on my seventh Prime Minister. Yeah. So I started in 1986 with Margaret Thatcher. Terrifying woman that she really was, and have known every Prime Minister since that time. I always think it's quite a privilege to be able to be in the House of Commons. I'm knocking on a bit now. My view about the future is that as long as I still get a buzz out of actually doing it, and I do, I get a sort of frisson of excitement every time I walk into the House of Commons, as long as that stays, I intend to stay. When that begins to dissipate, it might be time to hang up my pen.
Because I was in school when Margaret Thatcher went, and I remember it was my last year in sixth form, and one of the teachers running into the school common room and said, she's gone. And a few of us were sort of knew immediately who he was referring to. And obviously there were some who were not interested. But in those days, we really only had the main media channels. So it was, you know, I remember even going home and watching the 1 o'clock news. I think it was Philip Hayton that afternoon, and sort of trying to see the latest and to see what was going to happen and who was going to throw their hat into the ring. And John Major, of course, at that point, who was not all that well known. He'd been Chancellor and Foreign Secretary for a very small period. But in your case, having covered all those prime ministers and still getting the same buzz out of that, I mean, in terms of context, you must see history repeating itself over and over again.
Yes, I don't think that history can teach you lessons, but it can't tell you what's going to happen next. So every single situation is different. I think that, as we were talking about Ukraine, an example of where history came into play was when Putin invaded the Crimea. Now, the year he did it was 2014. And in 2014, there was a big commemoration of the beginning of the First World War. Loads of documentaries and radio broadcasts and so on about the start of that. And I actually think that affected political leaders, because one of the things that came across was that how a minor terrorist incident, or relatively minor, in Sarajevo, 36 days later, the world was at war. And so the response from the West in Crimea was actually quite muted. And I think one of the reasons for that was those political leaders were thinking, if we're not too careful here, this could lead us into a conflagration that we are not prepared for, don't want, and we'll pull back slightly. So in a sense, history had had an effect on those particular events. And yes, you can see things repeating themselves. A prime minister will go up in people's estimation, then they will go down. And eventually, it is the old adage that all political careers end in failure is absolutely true. Eventually, they will go. They usually make one big blunder and off they go. In that sense, there's a repetition. But each event is different. And still, I'm not able to predict, even after all that experience, exactly how the next day will go in politics.
Yeah, and you must find as well that, I mean, whereas the press, once upon a time, everyone would be looking, you know, I'd be getting on the train in the morning and you'd be queuing up before boarding the train to see what the main stories were overnight. I mean, and then I think during the Gulf War in 91, that was the time when it was quite clear that TV was leading the debate, that the newspapers were always, you know, playing catch-up. But there must be a point now where, with social media as well, there's such a plethora of ways, it certainly democratises news, but there's such a plethora of ways of getting access to information that ensuring that the right people are accommodated by what you write, for example, what you broadcast, that must be a particular challenge that you could never have foreseen all those decades ago.
No, and I think that what has happened is the nature of news has changed, and so the nature of politics has too. So if you look back to 91, we didn't have websites, for instance. There was no social media. We were just starting out on 24-hour news on the TV. Now news becomes is a 24/7 operation. One of the things that I think politics tries to do, and perhaps shouldn't quite so much, is fill all 24 hours. So they're now timing announcements to try and hit that particular market, that one there. I'm not sure that works terribly well. Often you end up manufacturing material just to actually satisfy the beast. So news is different. People get their news differently. Most people know what's going on through social media, or they're looking at media websites, or they're catching a bit of news here and there. But the days when people would read their newspapers for news, they've gone. That's gone completely. And papers now are much more looking at analysis of what is happening and trying to look forward than just simply presenting the day-to-day news.
Yeah, and even with newspapers, I will always read online. So I sort of read newspapers, but I'm very aware that I'm reading digital versions of them. And I'm also very conscious, of course, that I suppose the advertisement is where the money is made. But I'm not actually paying for a newspaper in the same way. I'm getting lots of stories, and I'm also being very selective. You know, I'll automatically go to the politics section. But you know, if I was to buy the newspaper, I'm sure there are plenty of pages I'd just say, oh, something in football, or something's going on in the world of sport or whatever, and I would just ignore those things. So I think there's more information, but we're also becoming quite niche. We're only focusing on what it is that we're interested in.
I'm not sure. Yes, I think that probably was always the case. Yeah. I'm not particularly interested in football, yeah. And so I very rarely read any of the sports pages. Yeah. And this is a writer I know, and I happen to want to actually see what he's saying. So yes, I think that is probably true. Obviously, if you're reading the websites, the chances are you're getting that news earlier anyway. And that's the difference between what it used to be like and what it is now. Newspapers do feel a bit late when it comes down to producing stuff, which is why they have to do the whole thing differently. So the idea now is, if you actually like the feel of a newspaper in the same way you like the feel of a book rather than a Kindle, then a newspaper is for you. And what that will be presenting is an entire entertainment package, which should be saying to you, right, here's your politics, it's there, but you might like a bit of showbiz as well. So broadly, a newspaper is something that you enjoy reading in the same way you enjoy reading a book.
Yeah, and I remember, as I'm reading, and I said this to Joe, who I interviewed months ago, which must suggest that I'm a very slow reader, but I do read other things, is Alistair Campbell's diaries, which is just fascinating in terms of the insider approach. And I've always found political biographies interesting because what you get through the media, of course, everyone's going to be spinning a particular yarn, and it's fascinating when somebody has an autobiography out a few years after the events, when the dust has settled, because then you start to see that the things that they were absolutely not going to talk about at the time, because it may have brought down a particular leader or they had a particular axe to grind, but then you start to see that maybe the things that people were saying about those politicians and how they may have felt uncomfortable with their leader, or they might have, you know, been considering resigning over a certain matter, are true. So I always think that there is authenticity, but you're not going to always find that from the day-to-day media grill, where of course obviously a slip up from a politician is going to be potentially catastrophic, so they have to watch their words very carefully. But in terms of penetrating surfaces, because you obviously know all of the politicians, is there a sense sometimes that you know more than you're able to write in your columns, but you have to be respectful to them just to make sure that they're going to continue to use you as a source?
Not in the sense of covering stuff up. There's an awful lot that I end up knowing or finding out, which for a variety of reasons we don't publish. It may be there's a national security reason, which is quite frequent. It may simply be a privacy reason, where we're tied up by fairly strong privacy laws. It may be that you actually think you know something, but you can't absolutely confirm it. You mentioned political biographies, Chris. I find them the most irritating read of everything, because they tend to confirm the things I knew at the time that the individual was then denying, and it suits their purpose to rewrite history so as that they are the hero of that particular episode. And when there was something that I almost got around to writing and didn't quite, because I wasn't able to absolutely confirm it, then it pops up in someone's biography and it was all true all along, I do find myself getting quite furious about that.
Actually, you've just made me think, it was Peter Mandelson's his Third Man. It was a fascinating read, but what I was really interested in is, of course, he spent a lot of time in Europe, and yet when you're reading it, you think that he's there at the centre of everything. And I suddenly, I was like, oh, three quarters of the way through, and I thought, hang on, he was in Brussels at this point, but you'd think he was in the same room with Tony Blair, the same room as Gordon Brown. So I think there was an interesting element of historical revisionism where somebody's going to perhaps say, well, you know, at the time I might have felt sidelined, or this is where I was, or this is where I wanted to be. But of course, it's your narrative. It was, I think it was John Prescott who, when asked about the truth of what happened in that infamous 1994, was it the Granita or
that's right,
the restaurant?
Yes, it was, yes.
And he said, well, they're both right. You know, it's not that one, you know, Tony Blair's account is true and Gordon Brown's false. He said they both believe their own narratives. And that made me reflect, and I thought, that's probably right, because at the end of the day, everyone, no story comes without some form of context. There's, you know, is there such a thing as an objective happening, or is it the particular spin, the particular interpretation that the journalist or the politician brings to it?
I think probably it's a bit of all those things. I mean, certainly that particular dinner that you're talking about, where they're meant to have thrashed out the leadership, both Tony and Gordon left that dinner with completely different ideas about what had happened there. And in a sense, it's sort of... in each case, the facts were broadly right. It was the interpretation put on those facts which changed so hugely. I think that's actually a problem of politics as a whole, that the facts that politicians choose are always selective. So when they throw a load of statistics at you, as you often as they often do in the House of Commons, those figures are right. But when you actually examine them, they don't tell the full story. And then an opposing politician will come up with a load of new figures to disprove the first lot. Those figures will be right too, but again, they don't tell the whole story. And a very quick example of that, I was doing something back in the Labour days when Tony Blair was Prime Minister, and it was over NHS waiting lists. And what was happening was that they had a four-hour target to get you out of A&E. You'd be seen in A&E, that was the target. And they were meeting that target 90% of the time, which was really impressive. So the figures looked very good until you delved into them. What turned out to actually be happening was, as you got nearer the 4 hours in A&E, the hospital would move you to a different part of the hospital. So you were still ill. You still had been seen by somebody, but only a cursory kind of screening. You certainly hadn't been made better. The idea that you were in a position to then walk out was a complete nonsense. So the figures themselves just weren't telling the story behind what was going on.
And do you think that it was harder or easier for politicians in previous years to get away with that kind of thing? Because these days you have an instant rebuff. I remember that a good example is the 2017 general election, when it was the Murdoch press who had something on the front cover that effectively said, you know, if Jeremy Corbyn becomes prime minister, you know, then it'll be a disaster. But then within minutes or hours, you had people on social media using that particular headline and turning it on its head. So they made a caricature out of that morning's news in a way that couldn't have happened, say, in 92, which was, you know, the famous that the Sun won the election for the Tories.
That's right. Yeah.
So I wonder, in that sense, whether people are getting just very savvy in that sense, and that there's that need to really be able to counter statistics or data or arguments, but to the point that actually you can never be a master of all of it because there's just too much data out there for any one person to process.
You're absolutely right that nowadays it's much quicker to take apart, and so people don't get away with it quite the way they did. I mean, this is where I think that the media is basically so important. You need that kind of scrutiny on politicians and what they're doing to make sure they're actually telling you the truth and that they're telling you the full story. And if they don't, it's our job then to do that. So, in a sense, that part of the job has not changed. I think the speed with which it moves certainly has. So if somebody decides to come up with a load of figures that aren't not necessarily not true, but can be picked apart, they're picked apart an awful lot more quickly.
Yeah. And what about the journey for you? Because you've been doing this job for a number of decades, but is this something that you could have imagine doing? Did you always have that thirst from childhood, for example? Did you ever imagine you'd be right at the heart of Westminster and covering the politics of the day?
I think from my teenage years, it was kind of the place where I always wanted to be. Yeah. From that point onwards, I was interested in politics. I was interested in writing. I sort of discovered, probably had a talent for writing at about the age of 10 or 11. So more or less, I knew roughly what I wanted to do. I wanted to write for a living, if that was going to be possible. I probably wasn't going to be the next T.S. Eliot. I learnt that fairly early. So my ambitions were tempered slightly, and so I ended up on newspapers. I think if I was looking back now at where I was at, say, when I left school at 18, and looked at the various things that have happened to me since, I'd have thought, cool, that was really exciting. I've really sort of achieved something there. It's not like, it doesn't feel quite so much like it as you're doing it. But there are things I've been able to do over the years I always wanted to. I was able to write a political novel. I appear on TV frequently. This is something I'd have dreamt about at the age of 18. I've been a columnist in a national newspaper. I've written for national newspapers for coming on for 40-odd years now. So in a sense, all the things I'd set out to achieve at the age of 18 have actually happened. And the only thing I suppose I would say about it is that you'd imagine your life would be absolutely magnificent at 18 if all those things happened. Mm-hmm. And of course, real life is not quite like that.
Yeah. But it was said, wasn't it, Michael Heseltine, I'm sure he's denied it, but that he'd mapped out his political career. So he'd have become prime minister at a certain age. And of course, it didn't quite happen that way. He became deputy prime minister, but obviously circumstances, including a health episode, obviously intervened. But could you ever have seen yourself, do you think, on the other side, and actually having covered so many politicians, actually thought, I could do a better job than them?
There was a time. I was based when I used to work for the Daily Mail in my younger years. I was sent to New York as a foreign correspondent. During that particular period I was there, the SDP back in Britain was beginning to be formed. So David Owen, Shirley Williams, Bill Rogers and so on. And I really liked the look of that. And one of the things that I would say then back in New York was, I want to go home to be an SDP MP. I think probably I'd been slightly swayed by the American media. The Americans really liked the idea of the SDP because they saw it as a way of getting rid of what was then an ultra-left-wing Labour Party, and obviously a Labour Party dedicated to getting rid of their nuclear weapons. So the SDP was attractive to the American press, and which is obviously what I was reading at the time. And I think I got a slightly kind of rose-tinted view about them. Once I got back to Britain, that kind of dropped away. I could see that the SDP wasn't really going to go anywhere. It wasn't going to break the mould as David Owen has promised. And also about that time, I then went into Parliament myself as a political journalist. And I have to say that I get most of the benefits the MPs get without the irritation of having to be re-elected to my job every 5 years. And so I decided I was much better off staying on the sidelines than actually becoming one of the players.
Yeah. And have you ever felt that maybe you have directly or indirectly contributed to a particular, maybe the rise of a career, or perhaps somebody's been in the right place at the right time because you put them there in your columns? Have you been instrumental in determining the course of political action in Westminster?
I'm not sure about that I have it as far as the people are concerned. Certainly we've influenced events. So to give a fairly recent example, that we ran a campaign on the Sunday People against bedroom tax. And at the time, the Labour policy was not to scrap bedroom tax, but if people couldn't move, then that they wouldn't have to pay it. So it was a kind of halfway house thing. Thanks to the various things that we uncovered during our investigation, Ed Miliband changed Labour policy, and it became one where bedroom tax would have gone. Sadly, Ed didn't become Prime Minister, and so it never happened. But when it came to actually changing someone's ideas, yes. I think that I've written a lot about minimum basic income. I'm quite interested in the idea to see if it might work. a number of politicians have read what I've said and have talked to me about it because they've been attracted to it. Ed Miliband was one, John McDonnell was another. Now, I'm not sure the ideas were in their head as well. So it's kind of nudging events forward rather than influencing it, rather than changing them. But the idea of actually making somebody as a politician, no. I mean, there's a lot of journalists out there doing a lot of things. We do kind of coalesce when it comes to people we see who look like are going places that will build up their career. And in a sense, Rishi Sunak is a classic example of that. His career very much built up by the media, who were very impressed with him. And as often happens in politics, the higher you go, the quicker you can fall.
Yeah, and I think you're right, because prior to even the first lockdown, when he became Chancellor only a month or so before the lockdown in 2020, and of course, he'd been Chief Secretary before then, but he wasn't really a household name. I don't think he had maybe a very junior role in Theresa May, but he was not a well-known figure. And then suddenly people were talking about him as the next Prime Minister. Mm. But as we know from today's news, well, I say today's news, but by the time this goes out, who knows what will have happened. And of course, obviously, he's had a lot of flack in recent days. But I also think of some of those stalwarts. I think on the Tory side, Ken Clark, who of course has had a few renaissances, but a far more interesting figure in many ways, because he really has been there throughout. And he's the sort of figure who, when he returned to cabinet under David Cameron, he was somebody who sort of, he'd been there, he almost sort of was not blasé about it, but it always felt as though, you know, he was by far and away the most experienced person in that administration, but also the far more interesting, because he brought so much historical baggage there. Do you find that it's possible to be very sympathetic to figures on the other side of the political divide? I mean, my leanings are more left-wing, but I do find someone like Ken Clark a very fascinating figure, very colourful figure, who perhaps is far more attractive and interesting than many of his conservatives.
I liked him very much, and I also respected him hugely for all the reasons you say. Yeah. He was somebody who brought some real experience to cabinet, and having served in cabinet for so much of his career. Not all his decisions were great, but I think broadly he was most of them were. And he probably would have made a great prime minister. I'm not even sure he wanted to be prime minister, frankly, but I could see someone like that doing it. When it comes down to the political divide, I like Tony Blair very much. I think he made a huge error when it came to Iraq and destroyed his legacy as a result of it. But I do think he's probably the best politician I've known in my career. Equally, I like David Cameron. I enjoyed his company. I thought he was very funny. I thought that he had quite a lot of depth about him. So it was regardless of whether they were Labour or Tory. I like Nigel Farage, and Nigel and I don't agree on any particular bits of politics. But I do think that someone like Nigel Farage will go down as the most influential politician of the early 21st century on the basis of Brexit. Brexit would not have happened without him. And as a result of that, Brexit is such a fundamental change to our constitution that the fact that he's achieved that then makes him hugely influential. I'm a Remainer. I don't agree with anything that he said, but I do recognise, and I do personally like him, I do recognise the importance of what he's achieved, and therefore the influence he brought to bear.
Yes, and I do think that, and everything you've said is something I'd agree with, and I think the decision not to let him go to the House of Lords, but the very obvious sort of briefing against him. People were elevated to the House of Lords who seemed to be the sort of common or garden politicians, but suddenly someone like Farage was noticeably absent. And of course, he could turn that into his whole spiel about, hey, you know, it's the establishment, which in many cases he was, in terms of his background. You know, he was a banker. But in some ways, I think that sort of outsider status has actually served him an awful lot of good.
Yeah, well, that's what he is. Yeah. He's been an outsider, but I mean, certainly David Cameron would never got around to having the referendum in 2016 had it not been for Nigel sort of trumping at his heels. So the House of Lords thing, would he have wanted to go? Don't know, really. I'm not quite sure obviously, because he wasn't a member of a political party, it wouldn't have come through a political honour. Yeah. And then you'd have to say services to what exactly? Yeah. So I'm not sure he would ever have been in line for that. More interesting would have been whether or not he would have been a useful ambassador to Washington when Donald Trump was in the White House. I see an argument that we could have actually given him that role. And because he was able to talk to Trump in a way that nobody else could, that might have been useful just for that period. It was an unlikely thing to happen. It would have been a bit too controversial. But it might have been an interesting result had it taken place.
Yeah, and how close is the relationship in I mean, with the obviously there are some press who obviously are the scourge of politicians, and there are some parliament, you know, I'm sure there are plenty of MPs who have their particular go-to. I'm sure it's you in many cases, if there's a story that they want to see broken. But are there any instances where you can say that actually you have really quite good relationships with politicians and a mutual respect, and perhaps in some cases outside of the party affiliation, as you were just indicating with respect to David Cameron?
Yeah, and it's an interesting one that I think that we get down to a human level here. Yeah. Whether you're a politician or journalist, I think some people like each other and some people don't. And so some of the basic things about human nature come into play here. And there are politicians of all sides I've got along with well because I happen to like them. One of the things I've tried to do throughout my career is not to become friends. I think that's actually crossing a divide. There will come a time for each one where I'll have to write something that is going to upset them, may even destroy their career. And to be a friend would make things like that very very difficult. However, the House of Commons itself is an institution. It is very difficult not to actually become friends with people. So I try and keep it as friendly rather than as friends. But for instance, my daughter decided that when she was getting christened, when she got christened as an adult, she would choose her godfather. Her godfather was a Tory MP.
Yeah.
But there you go. I mean, he'd been a friend of the family and so on. But I can count on really on one hand politicians I would describe as friends.
Yeah, and you always say, and actually one thing about that this week, because Diane Abbott famously, wasn't it, her son's godfather was Jonathan Aitken, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
So in that sense, and also that humanised things, because you'd see the Michael Portillo, or you'd see Jackie Smith, or Diane Abbott, and you'd see politicians from very different backgrounds, but able to respect, to listen to each other. And there was something obviously very non-adversarial in that particular sort of format, which actually made them far more interesting as human beings, because Prime Minister's question actually works well in a very gladiatorial way, that if there isn't a spark flying,
but it's a show.
It feels disappointing. Yeah. And wasn't it Bruce Forsyth who always used to say that he'd watch PMQs as fodder for his performances, because he said there was more comedy in PMQs, or in terms of getting the cues right, in terms of making sure that the blows land.
Yeah, and I think that the PMQs really is just a show.
Yeah.
That the whole thing about, again, politicians are human beings. And there are those who respect each other from different parties. It's not a the partisan breakdown actually in the House of Commons outside the chamber is not very great. They will go drinking with each other from different parties. They, as I say, they will respect each other from different parties. Usually the people they don't like are on their own party. It's the old Winston Churchill adage that the opposition is in front of you, your enemies are behind you. That's absolutely true. So most of the arguments and the rivalry take place within the parties themselves. But I think, you know, MPs are human beings. And I couldn't have been doing this job since 1986 if I didn't actually like MPs as a group of people. I think that they are basically good people trying to do basically good things. Not all of them, but the vast majority of them fall into that category. What then goes wrong is events. And a lot of the, when they are corrupted, I don't mean in a financial sense, but when they make decisions which you're thinking are morally dubious or just plain wrong, often it's the event that has actually overtaken them. None of them set out to end up in that situation.
Yeah. And just going back in terms of your own life and career, I mean, things like earliest memories. I mean, obviously politics is a big part of your life now, but what about music or film? Is there anything, I mean, for me growing up, I wasn't a very big film person at all, but that's something that I cultivated much later on, if that's part of my research. Music is something I was obsessed with, radio, and always have been, particularly music radio. But is there anything from outside the world of politics that has carried with you since childhood?
Well, I mean, I'm not even sure they're terribly relevant. If I was looking for what I consider to be my favourite film as a young child, and one that I still think is the best war film ever made, it's Zulu. Got nothing to do with anything particularly, but there would be, if someone said to me, name your favourite film, it has to be that, because I've watched it over and over again. Films like All the President's Men naturally influenced me, because I wanted to be either Robert Redford or Dustin Hoffman. I'm not quite sure how true that was about the way they investigated Watergate, but there you go. So in a sense that I've got those memories, but I wouldn't describe myself as a great music buff, a great film buff. My wife gets irritated when I want to put on Gregorian chants because I find it relaxing, and she describes it as my mad monks. But again, it hasn't been a huge influence as such.
Because I think there's always this notion of counterpoint, and I guess you see it with politicians. I remember listening to Alan Johnson when he was when Alan Johnson was being interviewed by Simon Mayo, and he was talking about his memory of the early 1960s and the charts from that era, and growing up in a very working class environment, and we know well before he became, you know, a cabinet minister, and of course John Major in cricket. I've heard John Major being interviewed, and you know, politics isn't mentioned once. I'm sure that was part of the deal, and he would talk about it was The Happening, the song by the Supremes played a big influence at one point, and he was talking about cricket, of course, and that famous 92, because it was exactly 30 years ago when we had that, the first election which I voted, and you know, the warm beer and cricket thing, but that humanizes politicians, and I suppose sometimes they can play on that. There was just before he became Prime Minister, I think Boris Johnson was talking about playing with toy buses when he was young, and it always seemed a sort of a strange claim to be making, but is there anything like that in your life, something, the Gregorian chants is one, something that has nothing to do with the world of politics but is your safe place, a refuge that you can go to where you can just sort of, you know, find your own sense of value and to acclimatise?
I suppose it's sort of it is an interest in religion. I don't describe myself as religious, but I do enjoy researching history and so on. And I think I told you before I came in here, I stopped off in a church nearby looking for medieval graffiti. I'm still sure that at some point I will actually crack it and work out what it's all meant to be about. But this was written by, this was drawn by people who couldn't write at the time. It was their only way of expressing themselves. It is the only record they've left apart from in organised records, and there are very few of those around. So that kind of, if you like, takes me to a completely different world. Mm. So those are the things that are completely outside politics, although the way that the church works is incredibly political.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I suppose my next question is going to have to be then as to whether religion played an important role growing up for you, maybe organised religion, institutional religion.
For a while. I mean, I think that not growing up, my parents certainly weren't religious. I did get confirmed at school, and I rather regret it now because I think I did it for the wrong reasons. Yeah. It was a social event. It was something that was expected of you. There was nothing terribly spiritual about it. Much later on, I started going to church, like a lot of parents do, to try and get our then young daughter into the local church primary school, and got really interested. And for about 10 years, I was actually quite active in the church. So I became I was on the parochial church council, did quite a bit within the church. My disillusion with the church really is that, and this is why I don't like organised religion, is that it always seemed to be, I'm an Anglican, but only by birth. I mean, not. I think I'm a pluralist by nature. What I used to get angry about was the row over women bishops. I think it was extraordinary the Church of England had to wait till 2015 before a woman bishop was appointed. I continue to get irritated with them over same-sex marriage and their position there, or non-position, as it seems to me. And as a result of that, I drifted away from organised religion. And as I say, I don't really like to describe myself as being religious, although I am hugely interested in religions.
Yeah, yeah, and in my own case, I was somebody who had an Anglican background, but I found that there were certain questions I couldn't ask within the auspices of the church. So I did a degree in theology, and then suddenly that became the catapult. So I was no longer in any way belonging to a particular church. And I kind of felt it was an interesting direction, because people sometimes make assumptions about, you know, the fact that I teach, or indeed head of a department of religious studies. But of course, these questions are far more complicated than a simple case of allegiance. Mm. But they carry with you. And I think that those questions and that quest, and politics and religion are very similar, I think, in many ways, because in a way, politicians and lawyers can do the same. That you might go, you know, it's still like the John Grisham novels. You have the idealistic lawyer who wants to change the world, but ends up getting trapped in a system, and in the end, perhaps they never quite realise their
goals. About politicians, yeah, and events, that decent people are often corrupted by the events they have to deal with. And the worst thing, I think, in politics, and to an extent I suppose it applies to religious leaders, is that too often there's no right thing to do or wrong thing to do. There are two bad things to do, and the skill is choosing the one that is not quite so bad as the other.
Yeah, and you mentioned your parents earlier. I mean, did they have a very different sort of background? Did they have a very different sort of career to what you've achieved?
Yeah, my mum was a spy, so she worked for MI6. My dad used to run a farming cooperative down in Kent. Very different people. I don't think he was a spy, but I didn't know my mother was a spy until after her death. I only found out that she'd been serving in MI6 once she died. And there, if you like, there comes another sort of influence that you're talking about, and decisions you have to make quite young. That I didn't know this, when I was just before I was going to go to university, which I gave up to become a journalist. There was a move to recruit me into one of the intelligence agencies, and part of that had to do with my family background. So I never understood this. I couldn't understand why my family had anything to do with it, and it was only later all these things became clear. What was interesting is that, in a sense, it was the first time I had to make a decision about my future on the spot. I was 18. If I'd chosen the secret route, it would have meant that I probably would have been able to be paid to go through university. I decided in the moment that I'd rather reveal secrets than keep them, yeah, and turn my back on that particular idea. But it sticks in my mind hugely, because suddenly you're presented with a decision that you weren't expecting.
Yeah, yeah. I think I would struggle, actually, if I was a politician. I mean, obviously, I suppose I would be very good at keeping to the message if I had to. But I also think that I'd be itching to say things, because it's kind of in my character. If I'm teaching, it's actually great. I've got students in front of me for 2 hours. There's a sense in which I'm, you know, going to be very revealing, and I'm going to be very honest with and upfront with them. But in that respect, I probably would make a very bad politician, because I'd sometimes feel that I was wanting to let more go, should we say, than perhaps would be strategically, you know, a sensible thing to do. But you mentioned university. Did you actually go, or were you on the precipice of going and then changed direction?
My A-levels weren't very good. Mm-hmm. It would have meant a lot of sort of persuasion to get me into the chosen places. I wanted to read English at university. During the summer holidays, while that process was going on, I then became, I started working for the Kent Messenger, essentially a tea boy. They called us editorial assistants at the time, but it was sort of making tea. Then they sent me out on stories. And then I got bitten by the bug. I thought, hey, I love this. And so I just turned my back on the idea of university and decided to make a career out of journalism. What was interesting about that is the contemporaries of mine who did go off to university and became journalists, they were then some way behind me in their careers into their early 20s. I then watched them overtake me as they moved into their 30s. So it was an interesting sort of thing that I'm not sure whether I'd love to have gone away to university for 3 years and read books. Equally, I think I benefited from the kind of experiences I was allowed to have as a journalist. And so I became then the youngest reporter in Fleet Street. I'm probably now one of the oldest reporters in Fleet Street. I was able to travel an awful lot, which other which my contemporaries weren't doing. Found myself in exciting situations as a young man, which I wouldn't want to be in the same situations now. So there were a lot of benefits of it. And even looking back now, I'm still not sure it was the right choice. Yeah. I wonder if I'd gone to university, I might have enjoyed that book reading and still carried on doing journalism and politics.
Yeah, no, I'm a big believer that sometimes if there's something that you're meant to do, you will somehow end up doing it, just maybe not in the format or the way that you expect. But and it must have been very odd to sort of see people, as you say, that you were ahead of them and then that sense of being overtaken. But do you find that when you look back on what you've done, I mean, are there particular landmark places or events that really sum up your time in Fleet Street, particular moments when maybe you were right at the centre of action? Maybe you covered a story, you broke a story before anyone else.
Well, I mean, they're obviously you have stories that you break, and then events that you attended. One of the great things I think about being a journalist is you really do get a ringside view of history and history as it's being made. If it was a story I broke, the one I think that caused the most fuss was just before Margaret Thatcher's downfall, and I overheard Cecil Parkinson talking about her downfall and doing a kind of run through of the cabinet and what was wrong with them. He was very drunk at the time at the next door table where I was eating and he was dining. Huge fuss about whether ethically I should have actually eavesdropped. My view is, yes, I should. It was in the public interest. Then you get events that are around. So if I was looking at the person who I most valued having some time with to interview, it's not a politician. As I say, I've interviewed every prime minister over the last sort of 30-odd years. It's Muhammad Ali. I spent 3 days with him on a film set down in Mississippi, and just loved his company and loved the bloke and understand why Michael Parkinson was so fond of him and so many other people were fond of him, that I just think he was a great guy. So he'd be up there as kind of my top interview. Then there are the events where things like that I went to the coup in Grenada, and the events there was I almost got killed. So there were roadblocks with kids who had sort of pea shooter type guns, which they put to my head in the car as we went past, but they actually had a 12 bore down them. And so if anything had gone wrong, my head would have been blown off. When I got to the radio station where the coup was taking place, the guard with me at the time was fiddling with his trigger and almost shot one of my toes off when it went off. So those are events that stick in your mind because you were actually there. I think war particularly is something that really sort of affects you. I've never been in one for long enough that I did a couple of trips to Afghanistan with Gordon Brown. I did a trip to Iraq with Tony Blair where we got mortared, and it was quite an interesting experience to be under fire. Again, the event stands out, but it wasn't a big thing at the time. We were only there for a day. I mean, it was a day trip to these places. But those are the kind of events that you remember because at the time they were very intense experiences.
And it must be really hard, but not in a bad way necessarily, to switch off, because obviously you've, I mean, it's, you know, Michael Heseltine would always say that you don't retire Because, you know, I suppose he was obviously dealing with questions about whether he indeed very much, and he's still very active. You know, he must be, he's not far off 90 now. But politicians obviously don't, and I'm sure it's obviously the same with journalists too, where you don't retire. That word, you know, just isn't in the vocabulary. But is there a sense in which you're always on message or on target or always on call is perhaps what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, always on call and always thinking about it. Yeah. Again, it's partly to do with as we talked about earlier, the 24/7 news agenda. The other thing I think about it is that it has you have to be pretty obsessed by it to do it. So each event then becomes, you really do want to actually be a part of them and follow them. Also, in a sense that it's a bit of a family business, that my daughter and future son-in-law are both in politics. She works for the government. He works as an advisor for a cabinet minister. My wife is a politician and also has worked as a special advisor at the Home Office. I've got another daughter who works for a pressure group. So politics has become a bit of a family business. So often you find with the family, we are talking about it all the time. The interesting thing with my wife, Claire, is that we have completely opposite politics. And because we're both professionals, we have never argued about it. What we have done is discussed it. And I've learned things from her and see things sometimes in a slightly different way. Likewise, she's learned something from me and again sees things in a different way. But I'm Labour, she's Tory, I'm Remain, she's Brexit. We can still have conversations about it without ever falling out.
Yeah, and also, of course, that back to what we were saying about PMQs, that binary-driven, it makes good theatre. But in reality, if you're going to make decisions, if you're going to run a country, you can't. Well, I mean, the Donald Trump experience is a classic case when if you try to run an administration on adversarial lines, then you're just going to find that it's impossible to get a message out when enough people are trying to say, sorry, this isn't going to work. This might not even be legal. And so you end up with very, very mixed messages and then polarizing people as a result.
It depends what political system that you want, really, I think. That's what that comes down to, that we do have an adversarial one. We also have a voting system which tends to deliver a majority for a single party. What that does is it gives you some certainty because they can get legislation through. My preference is for coalition, when coalition can actually work. Now, I think that when we had the coalition in 2010, a lot of the things that Nick Clegg and the Liberal Democrats did was really impressive. I think they put a brake on some of the stuff the Tories would have done. There are areas where, I mean, the big area, I think, is you wouldn't have had this high personal allowance that has actually genuinely helped low-income people without Nick Clegg pushing it. George Osborne claimed the credit for it after the event, but that's what politicians do. But this was something that the Lib Dems actually brought in. Now, when Nick first told me about it, I just laughed in his face. I said, you'll never get that through. I was wrong. He did get it through. It's had a huge impact. They had a huge impact on education. I think that if it was possible to have coalition, that is probably the best form of government. But we'd have to change our political system to get it, and not always would it work. There is a danger about changing the voting system so you have proportional representation, because would you really have wanted 84 UKIP MPs coming in 2015, which is what it would actually mean? So if you can get the coalition right, I think that's really important. I'm not sure you always would.
And I think that's exactly what happened in Wales and Scotland, because I'm from Wales originally, and it was so interesting that you'd end up with the effectively the PR list, you know, so you'd have the members of the Senate who were directly elected from the people, but also you had the list system, which often led to some slightly strange results of people like, well, really? So did they have four UKIP MPs? Although the number fluctuated because, of course, they didn't stay in the party long enough. But as we start to wrap up, Nigel, I mean, would you say, looking back on your life and career, that your memories are predominantly positive ones.
Yes, and I wouldn't change anything. I've had a ball,
yeah.
And I hope that there's some years to come where I'll continue having a ball. And as I said, that the time when I'm no longer enjoying it, that's the time to stop. Yeah.
And can negative experiences, I mean, this is my big question about nostalgia, about, you know, the way in which negative things can sometimes have a positive end, that it's the reflection on something, you go through the dark night of the soul, but you come out changed, transformed, maybe a bit more worldly aware, you a bit more worldly wise. So negative experiences can sometimes have a positive outcome.
Yeah, I think so. I suppose I see it in a slightly different way. More the idea that what happened was somehow meant to happen.
Yeah.
And so if you look back, for instance, I mean, a very quick for instance, we have new editors want to change things. I lost my column several times. I was heartbroken to actually lose the column. However, looking back, I'm quite pleased not to have all the angst of doing it. So as it turned out, there were benefits from the other end. And that's what I mean about it seems to be a meant to happen. All the negative things that have happened, you kind of look back and think, probably that was for a good reason.
Yeah. And do you tend to stay in contact with people, maybe in politics or outside of it? You know, you mentioned Muhammad Ali. Obviously, he's passed away. But are you in touch with many people from, if you like, a different era? So people you'd go to as sounding boards, people for advice, people who may be the great figures from 20, 30, 40 years ago, who are the wise old men or women of their particular parties, who maybe are not, you know, in the front line of politics now, but who are very, very sensible. From, you know, John Major, I think, is somebody who I think Joe Phillips was saying this, you know, somebody who always speaks very commonsensical words. Mm. He's very wise.
He's statesmanlike now.
Statesmanlike in a way that, of course, it's much harder to be a statesman when you're actually in office because you're dealing with different fractions and tensions.
Yeah.
Do you have any of those kind of go-to
yes.
people?
I call them sources. Yeah. And so sources come from a variety of different ways. There are people that I still talk to who were around at the beginning of my career, and I do use them as a sounding board. I often use them also for information, or they are very keen to let me have some of the latest bit of information that they've got. So, yes, I mean, sources stretch over the entire 40-odd years, basically, and some are better than others, but equally, you're always trying to make new sources.
Yeah, and on my very last question, Nigel, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I think it's got to be looking forward. I like history, so therefore, on the basis of that, I do look back. And obviously, I like the history of politics. I'm really keen to know what happens around the corner.
Yeah. Nigel, it has been such a pleasure to catch up with you. Thank you for being my guest this week.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you very much. Yeah.